You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. For decades after World War II, social science in this country was consumed with the following question. How did Nazi Germany happen? How did an industrialized democracy turn into a fascist state? How did tens of millions of so-called good Germans go along with wars of aggression and with the worst genocide of the 20th century? What were the conditions that made it possible? And most importantly, could it be stopped from happening again? You see this in the political philosophy of people like Hannah Arendt, in the psychological experiments of Stanley Milgram and Philip Zimbardo, and in a proliferation of historical studies of the Weimar Republic. This is a topic that eventually faded from prominence in the academy, but has started to get a big revival since the election of Donald Trump and since the rise in power and in influence of demagogues and ultranationalists all the world over, from Hungary to India to the Philippines to perhaps soon Brazil. It's also the topic of our next guest's book. Jason Stanley is a professor of philosophy at Yale. His latest, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on the program.
So why did you take on this topic as a philosopher?
Well, I think that when we look just at history, historians tend to work on one period and one country in one period. But what we're seeing now is a movement that crosses different countries and involves very different conditions in different countries. So what's required now is a kind of generalizing that applies to Modi in India, that applies to Trump in the United States, to Bolsonaro in Brazil, and these movements are linked. So when you have a historical approach, well, you have just a focus on the very particular aspects of one country and perhaps generalizing from that. But what we need now, I think, is we need a family resemblance concept like fascism that we can then apply across many different times and countries.
Notably, you are not describing fascism as a coherent ideology. You're describing it as a form of political practice. It's something you do, not something you believe in. So what's your working definition?
So that's exactly right. Fascism is about power. And so people are constantly asking me things like, well, does such and such leader, does President Trump believe these things? And my response is, it's irrelevant, because fascism is about power. It's a set of tactics to gain and maintain power. So its fundamental value is power. So it's opposed to loyalty. In its current modern form, it requires ultranationalism. So the idea is it's a system of a hierarchical system of power with a leader at the top who represents the nation, where the nation is defined ethnically or religiously or perhaps culturally, and it's based on hierarchy, authority, and loyalty.
Let's walk through some of the elements. The first one you lay out in the book is a mythic past, the construction of a mythic past. What does that mean in practice?
Because fascism is a politics based on power and loyalty, its opposition is reason and truth. So it's an emotion-based politics where the goal in practicing these tactics is to make the audience feel like the leader at the top of the hierarchy will protect them from some risk and will save them from some loss. What loss? The loss of a glorious past. Every fascist leader sets forth this glorious mythic past where the people, it's always patriarchal, men were men, just like the fascist leader is the father of his nation. Men were men, and the people of the nation were respected just for being members of the nation. They got singular respect. Mussolini gave speeches where he was very clear that the point of the mythic past was it was explicitly mythical and was supposed to make people feel a terrible nostalgia for this past that never was. And it was supposed to connect their own feelings of anguish and loss at, say, economic anxiety or loss of status or nervousness about the future to loss of this mythic past.
And the mythic past does not necessarily correlate to any real past. This is the hallmark of fundamentalism all the world over.
The goal is to break. So since fascism is based on power and as it's opposed to truth and reason, the goal is to get people used to living in a mythical world. So it's explicitly fictional.
Explicitly fictional. Another salient universal quality of fascism that you identify is an embrace of unreality. The discounting of the relevance of facts or the achievability of a fact-based understanding of the world.
Yes, so this is another pillar of fascism. It's liberal democracy is based around two values, liberty and equality. And liberty and equality each require truth. Nobody thinks the people of North Korea are free. If somebody lies to you then and you act, well, you don't know what you're doing because you're living in a fantasy world. That's why we don't think the people of North Korea are free, because even though they might think they're free, they're acting on lies, so they're not free. Freedom requires truth. Equality requires truth, because equality in democracy is political equality. It's the power to speak truth to power. And if there's no truth, you can't speak truth to power. So fascism has to destroy reality. It has to destroy truth. And it does so by conspiracy theories, by a series of tactics. It gets people used to lying. The fascist leader is someone, a fascist leader is someone who repeatedly lies. And when it gets bad enough, the supporters know that the fascist leader is lying. So that can actually happen where the supporters are like, yeah, I know those things are untrue that he's saying, but it's all right because it's a game and he's fighting and it's all about fighting and winning. And since it's all about winning, our guy, by openly lying, is showing that he knows that it's a game about winning and he needs to use unfair tactics.
So when Donald Trump, for instance, starts declaring any critical coverage of him fake news, he's not necessarily saying the facts in this report are wrong. He's saying the institution publishing this is against me. They are disloyal. They're not part of my team.
So when fascism takes hold, there's no such thing as truth. There's only my team and your team. And you get your supporters used to just thinking, it's just my team. I am your man. I represent you. This is us versus them.
The other great inversion here is that a universal characteristic of fascism, as you identify it, is some kind of victim narrative, whereby what is typically the dominant social group in the country comes to feel itself the victim of the social order.
Absolutely. This is always how you can detect fascist inclinations. When the dominant group that holds the most power and traditionally has held the most power but is asked to yield a little bit to minority groups, feels that yielding is victimization. I guess the clearest example is the men's rights movement. Feminism is taken as a power grab.
Now, importantly, the way you describe fascism as a political practice is something you do, not something you believe in. You can have fascist practice in an otherwise democratic society.
Absolutely. So my book is about fascist practice. And fascist practice, for the most part, most fascist leaders come to power in democracies. Look at Brazil today, where Bolsonaro is, you couldn't be more explicitly fascist. He's running against democracy. He's virtually promising to bring back the military dictatorships. Many of his supporters are openly anti-democratic. He's calling for extrajudicial violence. So he's incredibly popular.
That's an interesting example because Brazil is enmeshed in what is one of the greatest political corruption scandals probably in the history of the world. This is another common trait you identify in fascist politics, is campaigning against corruption. Which is its own kind of rhetorical inversion, because Donald Trump is no paragon of anti-corruption.
It's only $400+ million that he got from his father without paying taxes on it. So all fascist movements, this is something that surprised me, actually, when I did the research for the book. I had you know, Kate Mann in her excellent book, Down Girl, talks about how when men run against women, they run anti-corruption campaigns. So she talks about a campaign in Australia that took this form. And she talks about the 2016 elections when Donald Trump ran an anti-corruption campaign against Hillary Clinton. And
literally Mann branded his opponent Crooked Hillary.
Crooked Hillary, literally, right. And Mann says what he meant was this is an inversion of the gender hierarchy. But when I looked at the Nazi literature, the literature on National Socialism, it's the same thing. So as I discuss in How Fascism Works, the secondary literature on the National Socialists emphasized how odd it is that the Nazis ran anti-corruption campaigns when they were incredibly corrupt. So people say we have this idea of the National Socialists as sort of like virtuous anti-Semites devoted to ridding the world of the Jewish people, but in fact, many of the Nazis couldn't care less about Jewish people, but they could care a lot about Jewish art, Jewish property, Jewish money, which they wanted to get their hands on. We find the same thing with Putin. In 2011, he ran an anti-corruption campaign, even though by some measures he's the wealthiest person in the world. We find that in the history of the United States, when W.E.B. Du Bois's great work, Black Reconstruction, is devoted to showing that Reconstruction did not end because of Black corruption. So even I learned in school that Reconstruction ended, the period when Black Americans briefly in the South had the vote and elected large numbers of state legislatures and congresspeople and even senators because they had the vote. And then the vote was taken away from them in the late 1870s, mid to late 1870s. And the grounds given were supposedly that corrupt government resulted from them voting. But Du Bois shows in Black Reconstruction that these governments were not at all corrupt. And the charge of corruption just meant that Black people were able to vote. And it turns out that in society after society, when minority groups or women are given political power, this is painted as corruption. Think of, for example, what's happened in the state of Michigan with the emergency manager laws. They put emergency managers in all six of the largest Black majority cities, deposing the mayor, deposing the city council because of supposed corruption, which of course resulted in the Flint water crisis. And why were they able to do that? Because many white people think when Black Americans are allowed to political power, that means corruption. And that's the fascist way of thinking. Corruption means corruption of the proper order.
In fact, if it goes hand in hand with the kind of us versus them division and loyalty that you described earlier in our interview, it's people thinking at some level, well, if my guys were in power, they'd be handing out some patronage and skimming a little money after the top. I assume that's what this other crew is going to do. And how outrageous that they're doing that for the other instead of my tribe.
That is exactly right.
Our guest is Jason Stanley. His new book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Jason Stanley, one of the historical points you make is that although the United States has kind of built its national identity on being the great anti-fascist savior of World War II, post-Reconstruction America was fertile grounds for fascist thinking and fascist social movements. You open the book with a story about Charles Lindbergh and the America First movement.
Yes. The United States, if anything, deeply affects Nazi Germany. So I should say at the outset, both my parents are refugees from Hitler, from anti-Semitism. My mother came from Eastern Europe after the war, but survived the war. And so there is a strong anti-fascist tradition in the United States. There are many Americans lost their lives heroically on the beaches of Normandy. But that said, we, from the late 19th century to World War II, there was a very strong, I don't know how else to say it, fascist movement in the United States. The KKK overlaps the ideology of the National Socialists very strongly. Hitler in Mein Kampf, the country he mentions as his Vorbild, as it were, as his model, is the United States. He says the United States In its immigration laws, he's speaking of the 1924 Immigration Act, which has been praised by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, restricts immigration to a select few, to racially select few, meaning Northern Europeans, and restricts immigration to those who are healthy from a, who are strong from a health point of view. So he's praising the United States for being the kind of racially selective nation that Charles Lindbergh, in his America First program, for which he was the spokesperson, praised.
This must lead you to questions of contingency, right? If fascist politics was able to get a toehold in the United States, why did it not come into full power the way it did in Italy and Germany during World War II?
Our democratic rhetoric has purchased. And again in social movements, from abolition, as in Frederick Douglass's great speech, What to the Slave is the 4th of July, to the civil rights movement, to the struggle now against these fascist forces, we find Americans reaching back for that rhetoric and its power. It's scarcely imaginable that Americans would say, let's get rid of this democracy thing. So even as now, even as we face a harshly anti-democratic moment, a moment where one party is calling basically for an end to multi-party democracy and for one-party rule through the courts, to seize the courts, to end with voter suppression and gerrymandering. Even here, they still have to pretend that they're doing it in the name of democracy.
The country's politics are shifting largely because the country's complexion is shifting.
Yeah.
And what we've seen in recent years is a real embrace of minoritarian politics by the Republican Party, using the levers of power to ensure continued political dominance even when they can't win a popular vote. Donald Trump lost the popular vote. The popular vote represented by senators went against Judge Kavanaugh. It doesn't seem like modern contemporary Republican politics is that many steps removed from saying, well, if the wrong people get to vote, maybe we shouldn't have voting at all.
I don't think it's any steps removed from that. Hannah Arendt talks about the one-party rule when politicians in a party show loyalty to party over parties, by which she means loyalty to their party over a multi-party democratic system. And there's no question that's what we're seeing with the Republican Party. They're explicitly talking that way. They're saying, you know, it's us or we'll destroy the whole system. So we do face that. The question is just, how are people going to respond? And I have some faith that people will respond, that we have more of a mechanism here, more of a commitment to democratic culture. It's just that we have to explain to people what's going on, and we have to urge them not to think in the party over parties way. And we have the rhetoric still has purchase here, the democratic rhetoric. Of course, as you rightly point out, the institutions are anti-democratic. The Senate is an incredibly anti-democratic institution that gives power to white rural voters who live in these states. If you live in California or you live in New York, you have just much less political power. And that's just not a democracy.
Yeah. Jason Stanley, I guess my question is, your book is incredibly descriptive about these shared elements of fascist politics. It is an incredibly depressing take on our current state of affairs. But it leads to the question, like, what do you do about it? What's an effective politics that counters fascist politics?
We live in a country that pulled off the civil rights movement. And whenever I'm down, I remember that the civil rights movement took place in Alabama, in Mississippi. I mean, I would have chosen Vermont or San Francisco if I had a choice. I mean, that was the 1960s in Mississippi and Alabama. And so given our country's history that black Americans and white Americans went down to the most difficult, treacherous areas in America to do that kind of politics and changed people's minds and affected political change, that should give us hope.
Yeah. That movement was also contingent on a specific set of institutions. Not just the Cold War, but also mass media. I mean, there's an argument that the civil rights movement would not have been successful if television cameras connected to national broadcasts had not been able to follow civil rights workers to the lunch counter, sit-ins, and so forth in the South.
The civil rights movement never would have taken the form it did if there weren't mass media. The civil rights movement was explicitly geared to mass media. When there's other kinds of media, the new social movements will gear themselves towards them. It's not like it just happened to be the case that there was a uniform television audience and the civil rights movement contemporaneously sprouted up. It was that, you know, the organizers thought carefully about how to exploit the local environment. So, you know, we have, you know, William Barber in North Carolina, the Poor People's Campaign. You know, we have sophisticated social movements happening in the United States, Black Lives Matter, the labor movement, the teachers' labor movement that's happening in West Virginia, in Oklahoma. So, you know, we have social movements, and these are social movements that, you know, there's, you know, in universities we have movements to unionize graduate students. So we have these social movements happening, and we're a country that is good at social movements.
So you don't think demagoguery and fascist politics are an inevitable consequence of a fragmenting media system wherein people are increasingly surrounded by information that reinforces their worldview, regardless of its fact value?
No, I think we're going to win this.
All right. Jason Stanley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jason Stanley is a professor of philosophy at Yale. His latest book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them.